Hello, everyone. Welcome to Combox. Game lives on. It will be living on later, but at the moment, it will be paused, I suppose, for Wagon Wheel. thank you to everyone. Wagon Wheel is the show in which we answer your questions on cricket. When you ask them, if you ask them, exactly as we ask you to ask them. The best way to do it is via YouTube Live on the Super Chats, if you get a chance of doing it. If not, you can go to our Patreon page, our Good Areas podcast over there, and you can support us, and then you can ask questions directly on that page. There's also, the Patreon's really good to get you the Discord, which most people love the Discord that are on it. It's a really cool little community. There is also a Combox Discord, but obviously that one's just started. We haven't moved that on as much at the moment. But yeah, if you get a chance to head over and support us on Patreon, all these things help as we build up, but also allows you to answer a question like Mob has, where he says, I loathe blood sports. Hopefully doesn't mean like the movie Bloodsport or Jean-Claude Van Damme, which is, of course, potentially one of the greatest movies ever made. Sorry. It's having a problem as my cat has come in and is now knocking things down here. But when I was thinking about a comparison for IPL's meteoric ascension, the only one I could come up with is the UFC bullshit. Which cricketer do you think would compete the best in UFC? And bonus point for which a UFC fighter could play cricket, if you know any. I don't know, was Conor McGregor one? Is he? Oh, I liked boxing, UFC. I watched it one night. I was at TalkSport. And so TalkSport has like every live sport around you. I was in a booth. It might have been when we were doing the New Zealand-England test matches and I was on my own. The rest of the crew were out there and I stayed back in the UK. And I watched UFC for like, I don't know, 3 or 4 nights in a row. And all I saw was people just rolling around on the ground together. I didn't get it at all. It didn't look entertaining at all as a spectacle. So apologies to the UFC community if I'm missing something, but it looked really shit as a sport. So if Conor McGregor was in it, would he be a cricketer? But which cricketer do you think would compete best in UFC? I mean, being that I don't really know what skills you need physically to be in that sport, I suppose there's a couple of players like old school, like Justin Langer, who did martial arts. Would they be pretty good in there? I'm not an expert on this at all. So I'm not sure I'm going to be of a massive help to you, Mob. I do like boxing, used to like boxing. It's got a bit weird recently, boxing as well. That's where that question went. It went somewhere. Abe says, please give us a three-cent story that didn't make it into your old Crick Info piece. One that you're allowed to tell us, of course. That piece is so long ago that... I'm assuming the fragments that I remember from Srisanth are probably more likely to be, the fragments that I have in my brain are probably more likely to be from the piece. Let me just think if I can think of anything else. I'm not sure if this is in the piece or not, but it shows you that he's got a very active mind and he's socially very aware. You know, quite often I'll go and do a project or somewhere and I'll take some photos at various points. And, I kind of go off on my own. So recently I was at Virat Kohli's training ground for the book, obviously. And so I was going off and taking some photos there of... And in my mind, I'm kind of writing, even if I'm not writing. So I was like, okay, so I want a photo of this because I specifically think this is a good visual. Or I want a photo of this because I think it shows you this fact, right? That's how I'm going through it. So Srisanth's in the back, might have been batting even, or he's bowling off like 2 paces, and he sees me go off to take a bunch of these photos. And I come back, and the photos I'm taking are kind of next to the nets, and they're showing a place of the ground, which is, so these nets are on the back of the Olympic Stadium. The Athletic Stadium. I keep saying Olympic Stadium, but it's where all the Olympic athletes in India, a lot of them come from this era. And so... you've got the Athletic Stadium here, you've got the nets over here, and then you've got this little area where there's kind of nothing there. It's, you know, it's mowed okay, but there's a little bit of rubbish and stuff, and clearly no one was looking after it all that much, right? So I go over there and I take some photos of the rubbish and the, you know, and everything else, and I come back, and quick as a flash, he's like, you're taking that because you're going to write about this is how far I've fallen. And that's exactly what I was thinking in my head at the time of like, you know, I've been to many situations where players have been in random nets and everything else. But he was right. What I was really looking for is Sri Santh now is not even in proper cricket nets. They might have even been concrete nets. I can't even remember. I'd have to go back and check the piece. But my first thought was, how is a player who was a good international player ended up here? And so I think it shows you a lot about his brain. He's so hyper alert about everything. And I think that's why we got along, because as a writer, that's what you are. Like we were in the lift together when he was at the gym. And he was talking to the woman, I always forget the name of it. Robbie always corrects me. Malayalam, is that the, I think that's the language. He was talking to the woman there. And as we're going down in the lift in her, in that language. And then as we halfway down, I said, are you trying to get free membership out of the gym by saying a journalist has come to cover you here? And he's like, yes. And I think that's actually that. And we'd only met like 3 minutes before. And I honestly think that's where we bonded. And sometimes it's as simple as that. Like, you know, I've done, you know, really long projects with people where me and the person has never really gotten along. But I think in Sri Santh's case, Sri Santh knew exactly what I was trying to do. And I knew exactly what he was trying to do. And we both just accepted that. And we're like, that's who these two dudes are. And we'll go from there. And it's not like I spent like weeks with him. I was like a day and a half, maybe 2 days if you count all the phone calls and everything. Like it wasn't a long time. But like I really remember so many details about that, where there have probably been other people I've been with for features for longer and I don't remember anything. Ali says, first class seems like a bad system. How can it be reformed and be financially feasible, as it seems like not that it's not like that in many counties? Or is it always going to be a loss-making development endeavor? So the most important thing to remember here, Ali, is that first class cricket was not a loss-making thing, right? It wouldn't exist now if it had never made money. So there's many different ways to look at how and why it makes money traditionally. And traditionally, it worked in the same way that franchise leagues now work, right? You could only play so many test matches, but you could have a local game once every 2 weeks at, you know, in your local area, right? And people would go. You go back and you look at first-class crowds across the world. They were healthy. I'm not saying they made a fortune. I still think in one way they're loss-making, but it makes sense to be loss-making because you're using that investment to get the players that you're making the money from in Test cricket. So yes, it's loss-making, but it's not as if there's no income coming from them, right? Like, you know, in order for Kumar Sangakkara or Mahela Jayawardene to exist as Test players that Sri Lanka made a lot of money off, right? They first have to have played in first-class cricket. So there is, it does actually, you know, it's slightly different from that perspective. The big thing is streaming though, right? Like people will really watch this. And we've seen this with Sheffield Shield and County Cricket. You know, County Cricket's going all in on the streams. Even in the Shield, it amazes me kind of every year I come back and there's a little bit more to some of the commentary than there used to be. You know, I remember, I'm not even sure there was always commentary. I think it might have been video only in the Shield when they first started it. It wasn't long after I moved to the UK. It was a long time back when you could get some games online. And so now you have multiple, you know, commentators and everything else. You know, at county games, people like me would go to a county game and quite often help out the commentator just because they were on their own, right? And they, you know, they would commentate the whole game on their own. Like it's, things have changed so much in the last little while. So I do think that is a part of it. Overall, I don't know how you make money off it. I think that's probably fair. There's a really interesting thing that cricket was obsessed with about 15, 20 years ago. No, I know. It was when we were making the film. So it was about 10 years ago. Cricket was really obsessed with darts because darts was one of the first sports that I'm aware of where there was like an organization of darts that was helping people get better at darts. And that was the whole thing. And then they had these cool little tournaments, right? And then suddenly there was this Premier League of darts that came in, scooped up all the best players. And of course, that money was split up only by the best players. And so it didn't filter back through to the sort of the grassroots of darts. Now, grassroots of darts are going to be very different to grassroots of many other sports. You know, it's a sport that you play in a pub. Like it's very different. But I know that cricket and some other sports were really worried about that from the perspective of what happens when the money only goes to the people who are, you know, setting up these tournaments and then the players directly. And so if we have a international test league, right, and it's done independently, there's a McKinsey report that's come out. I can't find it. If someone could send me a link to it. I know there's a McKinsey report that's out which has been saying many of the things that I've been saying for a long time, I would have cost them a lot less than McKinsey as well, and probably been less problematic than using McKinsey. But the point being that, you know, there is a possibility still that someone could come in and do that independently, separate to the ICC or World Cricket or however you want to look at those things. And if that was the case, what happens to first-class cricket then? I think as long as first-class cricket is playing its part in getting money from the international level, I could see why it will continue. But if there's a break, I think, is the interesting one. Master PPV says, it's pretty much always Callis and Sobers in the GOAT all-rounder conversation, with folks like Imran and Botham being a slight tier down, and then everyone else being further down from that. What is it that separates these top two from Imran and Botham, do you? Nothing. I would have Imran absolutely in the top tier there. I would probably have Imran. I'd have to do a deep dive, but I'm not sure I couldn't make a case for Imran to be ahead of Callis. Like, I've never done a deep dive into the two of them. So I've done a deep dive into Sobers and Callis, and I've got Sobers ahead of Callis, which is for a piece that we worked on a while back. But yeah, that hasn't come out yet, I should say. But yeah, Imran is probably, what, a top 15, top 20 bowler of all time. What's his bowling average? Around 20, 21. And in Pakistan on flat pitches a lot of the time. To do that and to still be, you know, a very good batter in his later career. Not a great batter, of course, but a very good batter. I think Imran's batting is probably better, more important than Callis's bowling. And I think it's probably harder to find a bowler like Imran than it is to find a batter like Callis, even though Callis is still a top 10. So they're very, very close. But yeah, all things considered, I probably have him there. Botham's problem is the last, I don't know how many tests he plays, but the last 10 years of his career, he's just not that level of player anymore. You know, you look at the first 20 to 25 tests, and I know people will say he played against some weaker Australian sides at that point, didn't play against the fully assembled West Indies. But it is also a physical, like, there's quite obviously a physical change in him as he enjoys his life a lot more and doesn't go on to be that level of player. And look, we know Sobers did a similar thing, but Sobers' athleticism is Michael Jordan level, right? And Ian Botham was clearly not. So I do think from that perspective, Botham is probably not in that tier. Botham is probably at the top of that Kapil Dev, Aubrey Faulkner, Keith Miller level, I would have thought, which is the next one down if we're looking at all-rounders. I'm trying to think of other players, if I'm missing anyone else obvious in that. Yeah, I think I would have thought that Botham is just that kind of that level down. But if you're looking at pure talent, I think the other three are, you know, a level. I've said this before. There is a 10-year period. I think it's about a 9-year period. But there's about a 10-year period where Imran averages less than 20 with the ball and more than 50 with the bat. That's the only 10-year period we have in the history of cricket where someone compares to Don Bradman. We, you know, Callis never did, Sobers never did. Like, that is just next level from that perspective. You know, and we've, you know, so when you look at that, Imran's on that level. Botham's first, I think Botham's probably the best starting all-rounder. Like, Callis starts bad with the bat. I think he's okay with the ball, but, you know, doesn't start well with the bat. Sobers bowls a little bit of left arm finger spin, takes a little while, then explodes, but doesn't really become the Sobers that we talk about now until he starts bowling medium pace, which is what, well, fast medium, which is what, 27, 28, I want to say off the top of my head. And Imran in the 70s is a decent cricketer, but I'm trying to think who you'd even compare Imran Khan to at that point. Like, he's kind of a raw bowler and his batting hasn't quite come across at that point. Both of them's really fascinating from the point of view. He just jumps out like a, you know, slightly older version of Suryavanshi, right? We just like, wait a minute, this guy cannot stop taking wickets and he's smashing the ball everywhere. And then that just sort of never happens again. That's kind of the end of that. At that level. Hurt says, is it a fair statement to say keeping ODI as a format is doing more harm than good to the game by preventing streamline of limited resources, energies, and calendar we have? No, I don't think so. The issue with the three formats, and I've been saying this for almost 15 years now, maybe even longer. The issue with the three formats is you've got one organization managing all three. ODI cricket, let's say you took out Test cricket and T20s altogether. Where would ODI cricket rank in the world? Is it the 15th biggest sport in the world? The 12th biggest sport in the world? right? Like, it's a massive sport still, right? But when you don't have anyone running it, and it's, they don't know what to do with it, and, you know, since 2023, we had a World Cup, there was lots of conversations about what they would do with ODI cricket, and they've done none of them, other than the ball thing, which is, like, the stupidest thing to care about. Let's worry about the future of this format. Like, how many people are enjoying ODI cricket more now because we have, you know, we have one ball, which we still have two balls, but as I've said before. It was such a stupid thing to care about, right? There are legitimate conversations, I think, to be had for the future of the game and ODI cricket. I still think, and, you know, things might crash before this, but I still think, you know, we should have, like they have with motor car racing, Formula One and Indy, what's the other one? The Dakar Rally, whatever it is. Different people should be running different sports. We are still in a situation. I would say maybe with Jay Shah, there's one of the first people coming through that is different with this. But the vast majority of people who run cricket around the world would not say that T20 cricket is their favorite format. You can clip that. Because I think it's a really important thing for people to hear that the people who are still running T20 cricket are not the people who actually really like T20 cricket. So we're probably not getting the most out of T20 cricket, right? That's probably why Test cricket has done well. And as I've said before, I do think there is a whole generation of administrators coming through now who actually really do like one day cricket. So let them go and run that. Abe says, what Stuffy changed since the World Cup to become this effective for RCB? He did go for a few last game, but still managed to get them crucial wickets. I think he's been bowling with the new ball more, Abe, as much as anything that I've seen. In the World Cup, was Matt Henry not getting the first overs? I'm trying to think if Duffy's had it every time so far. I'd have to go back and check. It could be form. He might be feeling a little bit better. I just thought his role was a little bit more jumbled before. He's still going for lots of runs. So he is getting wickets, but he's getting hammered at the same time. He was last time I checked. Sorry if that's changed. I'm trying to remember what game I was looking at. Satchmo says, did Brian Lara have a wider range of strokes than Tendulkar and Viv Richards because he could play the ball later than they did off the back foot? Yeah, so I think that probably Lara is in that upper echelon of, you know, which probably starts with Trumper, of the guys who can hit any ball in any direction, right? They're seeing the ball so much earlier than everyone else, but also, you know, they have the ability to keep the field in their mind at all times. And any great innings you see of Lara, you notice the hitting through the gaps. So we've had players like Tendulkar is great in certain parts of the ground at hitting through gaps. Richards's whole method was essentially hitting where the fielders weren't, which is more like Trumper. So it's not like those guys can't pick gaps. But if you go back and look at their great innings, you know, they're hitting where the big open spaces are, right? Which makes sense. That's what most batters do. And those two do it really, really well. And they both had the ability in Tendulkar and Richards to take the ball from off stump and slightly outside off stump and hit it to, you know, mid-wicket, backward square leg over and over again, which is an incredible skill to be able to repeat, as Steve Smith has shown us. I think in Lara's case, he can take a ball from wide outside off stump and hit it to a very fine leg, right? And he can take a ball from middle and off stump and hit it to backward point even finer if he has to. And I think some of that is that game he played when he was a kid, but I think he just has a mind mapping of, he can keep the spacing in his mind much better than other players could. And then he had the control of the blade, which most people didn't have. So I think with him, that's the interesting part of Lara, if you go back and have a look at his batting compared to other people. So there's a great stories about Graham Pollock, of Graham Pollock's ability to maximize every attacking shot, especially on the offside. So very similar to Lara, even though he's a very different, you know, kind of player. But what they always said was, you know, and I think it was Australia and England, both players talked about this with Graham Pollock, is you'd set your offside field a little bit deeper, and, you know, you'd have a backward point, you'd have a cover point, you'd have a cover, you have someone on the gully line, you know, you have all these fielders on the offside that are there to stop him scoring. And it didn't matter, right? Graham Pollock's ability to still be able to get that through. And I think that Lara has that, but I think Lara has that kind of everywhere. And I think that's the big difference with Lara to other players. It doesn't make him better than Viv or Tendulkar. It's just a different level of skill. And also the other thing with Lara is that it seemed to be with him. And I did about a 25-minute interview with him book, but I'd love to really sit down with him one day. I think it would be really fascinating to see. I think that was one of the things with batting that actually excited him. So everyone is excited about different things, right? And, you know, with Viv, it was the domination, right? With Tendulkar, it was like, you know, the perfection of the craft, right? Everyone's got these different things. Whereas I think with Lara, it's the, he loved the ability to just make it so it didn't matter where you put the fielders. Cam says, when I think of the great Australian teams of the late 90s, early 2000s, the classic lineup I think of is Hayden, Langer, Ponting, War, Martin, Gilchrist, Warne, Lee, Gillespie, McGrath. They probably didn't actually play as 11 very often. Do you picture anyone else in that classic lineup? So it's really important to note this. I think this is still the case, unless something has happened recently and I haven't seen it. I think the most test matches that 1-11 has ever played is 12 or 14. It's really low. And it's a West Indies 11. I want to say late 80s, early 90s. I think I'm right in saying that it's that team. So when you think of teams like this, you know, as you have here, I think this team played quite a few test matches together. So 10, 11, 12. But you've got to factor in, you know, Gillespie was often injured, right? Warne missed a little bit of cricket. Any of the batters there? Martin probably would have been okay by that point. Steve Waugh didn't play consistently all that much. He had all those soft tissue injuries, right? So he would occasionally miss a game. So you've actually got there the reason why that doesn't happen. Is that the team I think of? Yeah, I suppose. I'm trying to think. I don't remember Martin batting at six all that much. I kind of remember Martin more at four, so that's later on. So when does Martin come back? I kind of feel when Martin comes back, does he not play the Steve Waugh position? I think that's the point of, I remember someone years ago, I forget, a cricket writer wrote this piece and he came to me and he said, I want to write about the greatest slip fielder combination ever. And it's an Australian combination. He gave me the team at the slip cordon. And I went, I don't think though that was a slip cordon very often. And he goes, no, it was, you know, these guys. And I said, I think you need to go back and check your years because I can't remember what he had come up with exactly, but it was, I want to say Taylor Warne Langer or something. I can't remember what it was, a Ponting or whatever it was. And I was like, I don't think this was actually a very consistent slip thing. And it's like, so you kind of remember a side. And we've done this before. We do it on the trades show. It's really hard to, because in your mind, you're like, okay, this guy, but you forget that guy was injured for a while, or that guy was out of favor for a little while. It's actually really hard to do that. So this is a great question, but I think it was Kartikeya who came up with the numbers of the first team who had played a lot of tests. And look, it really does show you that we don't get as many of the same 11s over and over again as you would think. Anyway, let's have a quick break and we'll be back with more Wagon Wheel. Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible now. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN. All right. Thanks to Cam for that question. And the next one is Cam again. Well, that's easy. The common understanding is that Test cricket is still dominant in England and Australia, but T20 has taken over in all other countries. Do you think that is actually accurate? And if so, what do you think would have caused that? That's a fascinating one. I'd have to go back and have a look at the numbers, but I would assume that the numbers suggest that is correct. The other countries have been struggling with test attendances well before T20 came around. And I think that, you know, Australia and England have managed to keep that. Remember, Australia and England also, when they get those big crowds in, like the Australian ticket prices are actually quite low, but when you're factoring in that you've got 80,000 people on one day, right, or 60,000 people on one day, what's per stadium? Is it 55, 60? Charging 30, 40 Australian dollars a ticket, it's just a huge amount of money. So in India, even when you have a test crowd that is massive, the prices aren't as high. It's the same in, and it's not just the subcontinent, right? It's the same in South Africa and New Zealand, West Indies, right? So there are a lot of countries that even when you get tickets, you don't really make money off it. And so I think that as cricket moved towards cable TV originally, and now cable TV streaming and, you know, a little bit of free to air, I think quite naturally there hasn't been the same sort of energy to get people into the grounds. So I think that's a part of it. But if you look at other sports in Australia and England, they're also, you know, very much, it's part of the culture to go to these stadiums. The England stadiums aren't great, but they're not too bad. Some of these other countries, the stadiums are really bad, right? You can't take water in, right? You can't take food in. I think someone put up this on a Discord recently that he took his son who, I think he's Indian, the father, but the son was, you know, has been brought up in the West and he's not quite used to, you know, traditional Indian food as much. And so he tried to bring like some food in that he knew his younger son would eat and they just wouldn't allow it, right? I've been told not to bring zinc into grounds. I'm like, guys, have you seen how white I am? I'm going to need to bring some sunscreen into this ground. Otherwise I'm going to die. You know, so I think a lot of places we don't make going to cricket grounds particularly easy, but also then you don't, there isn't the monetary backing of that. But yeah, I remember being in Sri Lanka, I want to say 2011, it must've been England, Sri Lanka series. Where I must've been covering it for Cricket Info back in those days. And we went to Gaul, Colombo. I think those were where the test matches were. I can't remember going to Kandy for a test match on that series. And the thing that struck us was you wouldn't have known a match was on. And then we came back a few months later for the World Cup and there was this marketing everywhere. And I've seen that in lots of different places. It's very rare outside of Australia and England for general marketing for test matches. Now, some of that might come back to money. But when I've been to places for franchise leagues or when I've been to places for World Cups, you can tell that a World Cup is on. So I think the boards have kind of got a little bit of that to blame, but you'd have to go through every individual country, Cam, to really come up with the right reason. I think part of it was also one-day cricket got very popular in different parts of the world. James says, it feels like Australia picking Molyneux is going to hurt them as they will have to leave out King more often, who is possibly their best spinner. Isn't she ranked number one at the moment, King, I think? Do you know what their thinking is on this? This is a question I've been asked a lot over the last little while, and I haven't really, I haven't really been able to answer it until she sort of became a leader, and I think now it kind of makes sense, James. That I think they just really like the leadership, right? And they've put up, like, she's not young, is she? Sophie Molyneux, she 28. I haven't covered the Australian women's thing close enough to chat to people on this for a little while. So around the World Cup, I would probably have lots of views on this, James. But from the distance, I would assume that what they think they might lose in bowling at times, and you know the Jess Jonathan thing is also part of this, right? What they think they might lose in bowling at certain times, they're going to make up for in leadership, and they certainly seem to have put a lot of faith in Sophie. I mean, if she's a really good captain, and she's still a fantastic cricketer, right? If she's 28, what are they looking at? Maybe 6 to 8 years of advanced kind of, you know, what's a bowling average? If she's having a look here, bowling average in one day is 11. Is that right? Crazy. A bowling average in T20s is 18, right? As well. So they might lose a little bit with the bat compared to some other players, and they might lose a little bit in not having the wrist spinner available to them and everything else. But if they think she's also a genius captain, then, you know, that's all a big part of it. PJ said, we've had talks of a new New Zealand league. The new New Zealand league. Possible BBL expansion, a new 100, the Euro T20, the Belgium T20. I'm excited for that one. If you're setting up the Belgium T20 league at the moment and you need whatever you think I do for your sides or for your league, I'm available. I'm a big fan of Belgium. Love hanging out there. Been to many different cities in Belgium. Love Antwerp, Ghent, Brussels. Right, I'm in. right? I think those are the only ones I've been to. Oh, no, I've been to Bruges. I've been to many different Belgium cities. If you need a tourism person, yeah, I'm available. And yet we've heard nothing from the Saudis. What's up with that? What are your sources saying? Yeah, I think what happened was there was a... And if you go back, we sort of talked about this. I think the Saudis sort of came along and thought to themselves that they could do something with cricket. They've obviously had some other things going on in their minds at the moment. We were never quite sure exactly what they wanted to do, and I don't think they were sure what they wanted to do. So the options were their own sort of Champions League, right? The actual Champions League, a kind of secondary IPL / Champions League, with the three ones that we're looking at. I think that tells you that they didn't know exactly what they were doing at that time. What I've heard recently, in the last month, 6 weeks, is that I don't think they've really hired it. So if you go back, PJ, and you look what happened with golf, you know, they got Greg Norman, and I think they did a similar thing with boxing, and they've done that with a few. They haven't, from my understanding, really hired anyone. And I think that Neil Maxwell might have been that person, and it hasn't gone ahead. I don't know if Dean Kino was on that list, but there's a few guys that are not particularly famous in cricket that might be on that kind of a list. You know, Justin Gill, who runs Major League Cricket, is someone else you might have on that list, right? Run the IPL, was general manager of the IPL and is now running Major League Cricket. There's a few different people out there, you know, that you would understand. Stephanie Beltrami. I'm trying to think if there's anyone from the ECB as well. Yeah, probably a couple that have come through the ECB too, that you could hire and have as your person to sort of bring this together. I think when we start to see that, and I'm not saying it might have already happened, that's maybe when we'll get more of a focused plan. And I think that from what I saw from the outside and from what I heard from my sources was they want to do this and they want to do that. They want to do this. What about Test cricket? They're thinking about that too. There's just a lot that needs to happen. So remember, as we've said before, they already have relationships with everyone, right? They own DAZN. They have the IPL and everything. So yeah, it's possible also the Ambanis went, we can get you something, but just wait. Mob says, Gideon Haig has written about the numberless thousands of devoted amateur administrators who hold together the junior club interstate levels of cricket in Australia. To what extent is this the secret strength of Australian cricket, and which cricket nation has the next highest numberless thousands of devoted amateur administrators? I mean, England would probably have the highest, I would have thought. Or actually, Australia might have the highest because Australia has more cricketers than them, don't they? I think this is such a random grab, and so you're all going to have to ride with me for a minute. I think that Australian cricket is pretty monocultured. That's what I mean, monocultured, in that we kind of know how we want to play. Obviously, there's slightly different variations all the way through, but we do understand that this is how we want to play, and that having all these amateur people involved in that allows you to sort of have a unified voice even when you don't have it, right? Whereas I think if you look at traditionally English cricket, it's a lot more split into different regions, you know, slightly different styles, different weather, right, that has provided different things. Whereas, yeah, Tasmanian cricket is probably different than Northern Queensland and Western Australian cricket because of the surfaces, but I'm not sure if the key core beliefs are all that different. Whereas, you know, having spent a little time with Northern cricket people and Southern cricket people and privately educated people and state school, it feels like there's just little schisms all the way through. We haven't even got to Asian cricket, right? And Afro-Caribbean cricket. Everything's a little schism in the UK. And so I think when you have that, and I always think back to Iceland being good at football for that little period, right? Where Iceland were like, this is how we want to play football. And we are going to train everyone up in the country to be able to play football like this style so that when we get to the next level, Serbia in basketball would be another really fascinating one, right? I don't know as much about French basketball, although I do know a fair bit about French basketball. But again, French basketball seems to be another one that has like, they have a type of player that they like. They train up those players in a style that they're looking for. You know, they seem to have a lot of like 6'7", 6'8" guys who can handle the ball a little bit, who are, you know, versatile on defense, right? And you see them pop into the NBA as well. So it feels like some of those cultures have a really good idea of what the end game is. If you have that and you know what the end game is, suddenly having all these amateur people is really, really helpful. Converse that to the English cricket system, right? Which is Part of the reason they've kept Baseball, I think, is so they can get this. I think they're trying to understand this themselves. But if you go to the English system, it's very conservative. It's very split, and everyone does things differently. There isn't really, up until Baseball, a mode of English cricket that is played kind of everywhere in a way that, like, I'm not saying it's going to happen in the next 5 years, but maybe if you just kept going with Baseball and then just got better players in the next 10 to 15 years, but with that sort of method of, no, this is how we play cricket now, right? We don't just set fields and wait. We're going to be really proactive with our fields. Anyone who's coming through club cricket now needs to understand that this is a way that it is played. I'm not saying you can do this because, as I said, village cricket and club cricket in the UK is fascinating as a subset on its own. Whereas in Australia, I'm pretty sure if I left Melbourne and went to play cricket somewhere else straight after playing in Melbourne, there would be some things that I would have done differently. There would be some things I would have said differently. But we're going to attack, right? We're going to put pressure on. We're going to be verbal in the field, loud in the field, not just sledging, but be loud in the field. All these sorts of very basic things are transferable. So then when you have a bunch of amateurs who have a core belief system, I think that makes sense. Gideon is right about the amateur administrators and all these incredible people out there. But if cricket in Australia was all split up the way it is in some other countries, I'm not sure that would help as much. So there's a lot of magic sauce. And, you know, I've written about this a lot. Australian sporting culture is so interesting, right? When you go through it. I've never written a book on it, but like, I feel like, I probably won't ever do, but I feel like there's a really fascinating thing of when you break things down in Australia, there are so many things that went right for Australia to be as good at sport as they are, right? And I think in cricket specifically, this is another thing. Also, the other thing that I've talked about a lot is cricket in Australia is a team sport. I was always taught to play cricket as a team sport. And when I came to the UK, it was so obvious to me that it was an individual sport with a team aspect to it. That started to change the longer I've been in the UK. But when I first came, that was not the case, right? I've told this story before of, you know, me and this guy had a chance of winning a game together. And we put on about a 40-45 run partnership. And I was playing really well. These guys came on with a defensive tactic and it got in my head a little bit. And I played a stupid shot and went out. And like, I apologized to my partner. And he went, "Why are you apologizing to me for?" Or, "You went out." Like, I'm used to apologizing to partners because in Australia, you've let the other guy down by making a mistake. We had formed something together. We had a chance of going on. So I think there's lots of different things. But Gideon is right. There is definitely a beating heart of that within Australian cricket. Hurt says, LSG's Crystal Palace light jersey got me intrigued. Could cross-sport branding be the next big money frontier? NBA and Premier League owners buying cricket teams, name it the same, to stretch their brand across sports. I think that's happened, Hertz. I think there is a version of this that has already happened, and I can't think of the specifics of it. Is it basketball in Spain, where they own the football teams and the major basketball teams at the same time? It might have been a little bit more that it's been around for ages. I don't know. But there are versions of that already out there. I'm trying to think if there's any others. Yes, it will happen. The other thing that will happen is, I don't know if you can see my top here. I've got a basketball jersey. I'll try and bring it out as well. But this is the Indiana Fever, who are the WNBA side that Caitlin Cooper plays for. Caitlin Cooper? Caitlin Clark. Caitlin Cooper's a basketball writer. She's really good too. Caitlin Clark plays for. And they did a crossover with Stranger Things, which is what this is. I think that's why the Fever is written upside down here. And it's really fascinating. And that to me is another, and we've seen little bits. Basketball in America is really good at this, but we've seen little bits of this. I think Marvel did some stuff. And I remember being in South Africa a few years ago and their rugby union tops were Marvel. And I remember I bought a Black Panther one, Spider-Man and some other character, right, for my kids and my nieces, because I was like, that's a really cool thing to help get them into sport, right? And also the opposite is true, right? Kids who are into sport are maybe a little bit more interested in this level of pop culture now. So I think we're going to see lots of crossovers is the way I would look at it into the future as well. Ajit says, this might sound mean, But is the main difference in Sunriser and RCB batting the fact that RCB batters play with a brain? Mainly talking about the weekend games where both Sunrisers and RCB were playing on pitches where the ball was initially doing bits. But the top three for Sunrisers was just swinging at everything and looking so ugly, while the top three for RCB bided their time and knew that a good pitch would settle down enough to get a good score. Yes, they had a few plays and misses, but they were pragmatic about it. So there's a couple of things here, Ajit. RCB know they have a bowling attack. If you're Sunrisers, you know that you might even have the worst bowling attack in the league at the moment. Also, they dropped Harshal Patel from one game. Let's just make it weaker for no reason. So you're probably thinking at various times you have to score more runs. Two, you're talking about Travis Head is one of the Sunrisers players. Are we saying he's brainless? Like, I've done a whole video on the way that Travis Head thinks about the game. The man is a genius. I don't think anyone can argue that at this point. Like, he is, like, you know, at the cutting edge of attacking batting and the way he does things. So I find it very, very hard to think that he's not a superstar. But I do think that also you have situations where I've just done a short video on this, Ajit, which it's worth you finding about Finn Allen. So there was a game versus, I'm just trying to read my notes, Punjab. Finn Allen went out swinging early on and we had a bunch of comments going, see, he's never be good on flat pitches. And I'm like, yeah, but Finn Allen makes pitches flat because that ball's swinging. And in his mind, he's like, I probably only need to hit 1-6 and 1-4, and the chances are that this won't swing anymore in the future. So yeah, there's just more than one way to do things. I think that's very, very fair. All right, let me just find an ad, and we will be back very shortly with more. Brian Lara used pot plants to work on his placement. John Wright glued his glove to his bat. Sachin Tendulkar dug up practice pitches. Tatenda Taibu cut the top off his bat. Claire Taylor used a hockey grip. Steve Smith was from tennis. Dean Jones would call phantom runs. And Victor Trumpa turned the Nets into a war zone to survive. The best batters in the world do whatever they have to make runs. We have told their stories in our new book, The Art of Batting. Didian says, what is up with teams regularly having long on back, even for paces in the power play? It takes us over the thought process here. Are teams trying to bowl fuller? Or is it just teams becoming stronger down the ground? Your batter's becoming stronger down the ground. Yeah, Jason Roy would be, I want to say, one of the first I've seen. Actually, if you go back traditionally, we have seen, even in ODI cricket, that occasionally happening. If someone's just strong in that area, and you know, and you have the ability to do it, if you've got a ball full and straight, which most teams kind of do, it kind of makes sense. But yeah, I think Jason Roy was the first guy I can remember seeing that field for. And since then, you know, anyone who's strong in that area, if that's where they get their boundaries, doesn't it just make sense to fill it up? I think, you know, having the deep backward square and the deep square leg, deep mid-wicket, whatever you might have there, is fine. But if a guy doesn't score boundaries there, make them try and score boundaries there. So, yeah, I think it makes sense from that perspective as well. What you really want to do is, what's the easiest shot that this person scores boundaries on, right? Can we take that away? And if that's quite easy, and, you know, I think of Jason Roy, Phil Salt, I've certainly seen it a lot for. Travis Head, maybe. Finn Allen. So it's not everyone. It's just the guys that can get there easily. James says, in your view, how compartmentalized are cricket fandoms with regards to format? I think there's probably, in Test cricket and T20 cricket, there are very key demographics that never will mix, and they are both cricket fans, but are just completely separate to each other. I think that's very, very fair. But yeah, as far as One day cricket, I think there's a bit of overlap all the way around just because it's the middle format. But yeah, no, I do think we're seeing that. But I think we've always seen that, right? Like, there are people that are hardcore cricket fans that don't even follow, like in the UK, they'll follow their county team and they won't follow the international team. You know, I think that's always been the case. I don't think that's anything particularly new, James. It's just that it's maybe stretching itself in new directions. Kartikeya says, why is it often the case that multiple people from the same family end up being good enough to play professional cricket? For example, how are multiple generations of the Bracewell family or Amelia Kerr's family good enough to play cricket at top level? Isn't inborn or natural ability Is it inborn or natural ability also supposed to be a thing? I'm not quite sure what that last sentence means. Cricket is a sport where there are a lot of shibboleths, right? Like a lot of little things that, if you're not in an area of cricket, it's very hard to kind of learn them. So I think any child in cricket who comes in a area where there's so much cricket being spoken are going to pick up just little things all the way along that are going to be very helpful to them, that a player as talented as them from outside will just may never even be exposed to, right? So if you go all the way through, I think that's definitely a part of it. I think there is also just a part of it that we have to be honest here, that there are types of athleticism that probably translate pretty well in any kinds of sports that that allows, you know, people from the same family to do the same sport, right? So you've got that Norwegian family where they're all middle distance runners, right? Like, I don't think that's an accident. I don't think if I was brought up in that family but had been adopted in, I don't think I would be a middle distance champion. I think there's something genetically that is being shared in that family. You've got like the Marsh family, right? Where you have, I think Jeff Marsh's wife played high level of netball. The sister plays a high level of basketball. Mitch Marsh could have played professional Aussie rules. And obviously Jeff and Sean Marsh have both played cricket as well. I think you'd have to say that that's a pretty athletic family, right? There's something in there. And if you look at the Bracewells, you know, without being like the world leader in the Bracewell family, have a look at them. They're pretty interesting athletes, big and strong to begin with, quite broad across the chest. So I think there's something there. You know, you had what, with the War family, three professional cricketers come through in the War family. And again, look, they're really skillful athletes like that, and they're good athletes. Steve and Mark, I don't know the brother as well, but the other brother as well, but Steve and Mark, great fielders, really handy bowlers, and can bat. That's got to be a little bit of genetics, right? Grandfather and grandsons in Australian cricket. So what are those skills, right? Inzamam and his nephew, right? Do they have something which is something to do with processing? Is it that first half a step that other people don't have? You know, whatever it may be. But yeah, you can see why genetics would play a part in all of those things. Cricket, as I said, I think cricket just has a lot of secret society. Like, it's very hard to know everything about cricket, even if you read the vast majority of the books that have ever been written on cricket. I'm not sure that's the case with all sports. So I can see why there are probably secrets and advantages to being a nepo child in cricket, even over other sports. But if you look at running, boxing, basketball, rugby, there's a lot of sports where there's a lot of other family members who are very, very good, right? Chances are, if you're an athlete, if you've an international level athlete, right, then, and you have children, they're going to have some of those skills as well. Then everything else needs to come in to make them, you know, better or worse or anything else. But yeah, on top of that, just in New Zealand, there aren't as many people available, right? So you could see why there would be an overabundance of family in that kind of situation. Ali says, let's pretend the ICC is functional and solved all the problems with Test cricket. Well, they don't run Test cricket, but okay. There is now a proper 10-test team nation league with promotion and demotion. It'd be 12 if we're going to do that. And there are multiple divisions too for all the countries. Would that be preferable, or would you still prefer to see franchise Test cricket? No, you can do the same sorts of things as international level. But yeah, you would have what you really need is 6 teams in Division 1 and 6 teams in Division 2 and 6 teams in Division 3. I'd probably go further and say 7 teams in Division 1. 7 teams in Division 2 and 6 teams in Division 3, have 20 teams playing Test cricket with promotion and relegation, and no playoff for Division 3 to 2, but a playoff for Division 2 to 1, at least in the short term, while we know there's a noticeable difference. And if there isn't, we can take that one away as well. But yeah, no, there's no reason why we can't do that. But the ICC the issue that you have there, Ali, is it doesn't really matter who runs cricket. Someone has to run it. And at the moment, no one's running it. So that's why we don't have it. So whether it's a franchise league or not, doesn't bother me. James says, have England missed out over the last few years by not picking counter stars like North East and Hayne? Or is there something in their games which means they wouldn't be able to step up? I'd have to go through them, you know. I know Sam North East a little bit. Lovely guy. Been in my house with him. Doing some work for me ages ago. I'd have to go through his record to see if there's something there. But my guess is, God, I can't spell North East. My guess is with someone like him, where are you going to bat him in the order? Is probably in the middle order, right? Yeah, so the vast majority of his runs have come at batting at number four, right? Where he averages 46 for his career. I don't know if you've seen, but England have a pretty good number four, right? So then you can press him up to number three. When he's batted in first-class cricket at number three, he averages 34. That's not ideal. So you can bat him at number five. England haven't had a problem at 4, 5, 6, right? They've had a problem at 1, 2, 3. So how do you fit someone like that in? And I think when people ask questions like this, all they do is look at the overall runs and the overall record. If you're picking a side, you can't do that. You have to know where every single piece fits in. And in Sam's case, he's just unlucky, probably, that England have had such a good middle order during his career, right? And, you know, with someone like Hayne, I'm not as familiar with his record. Let me just bring it up. Where are we, Sam Hayne? Right? With someone like him, I don't know his record as much. But, again, he's batting at number four and number five. There's so many things that you need to look at, James, when you're looking at first-class numbers. I did this with Hildreth years ago. When everyone at Somerset kept telling me, you know, this was the missing link, and, you know, people would tell me how good he was, and you know, that we should look, you know, that he should be playing for England, and that was biased against his side, and all these sorts of things, right? And so I went and had a look at the time at his record quite deeply, because I was like, hey, these guys could be right. Like, I don't know that much. He was averaging 41 overall. So I was like, it felt a little bit low to me. But again, okay, I'm willing to look beyond that. He averaged 45.5 at home and about 35 away from home as a general. I'm just making those numbers up at the moment, but I think that's roughly correct. Do you want someone who to play in your test team if when they're not playing on their home ground, they're averaging 35? So yes, fantastic player, Hildreth. I've seen him bat. Sex on wheels. Hayne, Sam Northeast. These are very, very talented people. How do they fit into the side? PJ says, could you tell us a little about your backyard cricket setup as a kid? Did you play in the backyard, driveway or street? Okay. So we had a really rough backyard. So my nan used to live on a granny flat, so she sort of took up the space. So we didn't play that much. We would play on the driveway a little bit, but then we only had like a little concrete strip and stones on either side. So you had to bowl really, really straight, which probably why I do bowl really, really straight these days. And we would play a lot there, and we would play occasionally on the street. I don't think we had any fancy rules all that much. I think one rule we had was if you hit cars, you're out, just because we had to be careful not to hit, especially, you know, on our road, cars were coming up all the time and people get quite angry if a tennis ball was smashing into their window while they were driving. So I don't remember any unique rules. Try and copy anyone's bowling actions. Wazim Akram, Curtly Ambrose, Mushtaq Ahmed, that was the one that pretty much defined how I bowled. They would be the three. Or maybe Merv occasionally, I think. So that prancing sort of thing that Merv would do. Batting styles. I tried to turn myself into a left-hander when I was about 10, 11. And Alan Border was sort of the guy that I sort of tried to copy. I had this theory, which I still have now, which I should have been a left-hander because that allowed me to... I was so bottom-hand dependent when I batted. And I was like, it doesn't make any sense to me that my strong hand is on the bottom of the bat. It should be on the top. So I tried Alan Border. Can't think of anyone else. Batting style I really copied. There were little things from Javed Meandad and Dean Jones that I did based on them. And of course, when I played cricket, I tried to dress like Martin Crowe. So I suppose you would say Martin Crowe, but I wouldn't say I batted like him. Highest backyard score, I know. We probably got a couple of hundreds in there, didn't we? I never played cricket against my nan. She broke her hip. And also, I'm not sure are there many people I could bounce at my pace? So that was certainly something that didn't happen. But yeah, you know, bounce my mum, I'm sure, many times. If she can't play the short ball, what's she doing out there? Yeah, I remember that when there was this guy who was really, really upset when I was talking about trans cricket. And he goes, would you let your daughter play against, you know, a trans woman who can bowl bounces? And I was like, I'll let my daughter play against men who can bowl bounces. She's got to play in that level of cricket. She's got to accept that that is something that is going to happen to her, right? Women bowl bounces now too, my man. Not even to get into the science of how hard it is for a trans woman to bowl bounces, which is a whole different argument as well. But yeah, if you're out there, either play the short ball or get out of the way. Ajit says, might be a hot take, but I think Amelia Kerr's recent 179 versus South Africa is the greatest ever innings by a New Zealand cricketer. Man or woman. Just generally don't know which other innings comes close to that. Maybe her own debut innings. Greatest innings New Zealand cricketers. That's a fascinating one. It's a really, really good one. I would have to go through. I haven't gone back and looked at it. I saved a bunch of footage from it, but I haven't looked at it at the moment. It's obviously an incredible innings. I really want to go back and study it. I suppose Martin Crowe versus Wasim Akram and Wacko Yunus when the ball's reversing has to be up there off the top of my head. Bert Sutcliffe making 90-odd and being in hospital and drunk is really an important innings. A lot of the 1949ers innings, you know, considering who they were playing against and everything, I suppose would be high up on that. Some of McCullum stuff as well. Yeah, those are ones off the top of my head. There must be Williamson-Taylor ones, but I'm just trying to think of something specific. Astle's double 100 is one that's mentioned a lot, isn't it? James says, who wins an old cricket man yelling at the clouds contest? Neil Harvey in his prime or current Sunny Gavaskar? There's no one who's more old man yelling at the clouds than Neil Harvey. He's the genius at it, the goat at it. You know, this man who had this incredible career and life and, you know, and is so held on such a pedestal and just feels the need to shit on everyone. I don't think Sonny's like that. I mean, look, Sonny is getting old and his takes are, you know, like what happens with a lot of men when they get to that age. You know, they get a little bit less worried about the world thinks about them and they start opening up a little bit. But I think if you look at Neil Harvey, it was going on a long way before then would be my, you know, I just think with Neil Harvey, it's the consistency. And also, you know, some of the other stuff there. I'm just going to play a long ad. I will be back in 1 second. I once made a pair in a club game, which is almost impossible to do. But I have been obsessed with batting my entire life. And so I put that into my new book, The Art of Batting. Being that I'm not very good at that skill, I decided to talk to other people who were. So I hit up as many contacts as I could just to talk about batting. Rahul Dravid, Brian Lara, AB de Villiers, Kumar Sangakkara, Ross Taylor, Susie Bates, Nasser Hussain, Ian Chappell, and so many, many, many more. I wanted batters to talk about how they and their friends made runs, because that is the art of batting. Well, that's finally answered the question of whether I can get to the door and back. From my office when someone rings it, which is barely. The answer to that is barely. All right. See if we have any super chats, and then we need to get out the way because we have a watch along coming up soon, and we need all of our staff for that. He says not being able to find his comments. There they are. Oh, I don't see any comments here. Weird, really weird. I wonder if comments were turned off. Well, that's an easy wagon where then I can finish right there. Had I known that, I would have just said bye and ended the show rather than running between the front of my house and coming back. Thank you to everyone who put in chat. Sorry if you couldn't get any comments going up on this show and you were trying to. We'll fix that glitch coming forward. Obviously, we're quite stretched with the watch-alongs and everything at the moment. Really interesting piece that we put the other day about T20 players and what they're specialists in. Looking at some of the IPL numbers, which is fascinating about how you have to kind of assemble lineups and everything with teams. Go have a look at that, and we'll be back soon with a live watch-along of this IPL game. Bye. Thank you for listening to this podcast on the Combox Network. There is an ad-free version of this you can find by supporting us on Patreon at Good Areas Podcast. You can also access our Discord channel there. Please like, subscribe, and rate this show. Every one of these helps us. If there was a guest on a show, you can find their links in the show notes. Huge thanks to Ruckshit, Ishit, and everyone else who helps us get our content out there. If you want to know more about us, head to combox.tv. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.